Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Robert Cunningham, and he'll be answering your most important questions on chasing records. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Robert a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Robert Cunningham about chasing records. Our approach is simple. Education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Robert, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we're going to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine and a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for a drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Robert's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Robert's book, Chasing Records, courtesy of Skyhorse Publishing. And you can find out more about the offering Skyhorse Publishing has at www.skyhorsepublishing.com. And, of course, Robert's book, Chasing Records, is available on Amazon.com. And there are some links on his speaker's page where you can go directly to that. So, for those of you that don't win tonight, that's how you get his book. And here's how you can win. Must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talked about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Robert's book. Tonight our guest is Robert Cunningham. Over the past 20 years, Robert has set 57 IGFA world records on both fly rod and rod and reel. His saltwater records range from redfish inshore to dolphin and yellowfin tuna offshore. Among the freshwater records are bowfin and spotted gar found in the swamps of the River Delta. Most are the product of extreme challenge of light line fishing, and most were set on the northern Gulf Coast. But the list and the author's experience include tippets as heavy as 20 pounds and species from the Pacific coast of Mexico and Costa Rica to the Bahamas and the Atlantic. For every record set, there were a stupendous number of failed efforts and heartbreaking near misses. A lifelong resident of the northern Gulf Coast, Robert grew up in a culture and a family where going fishing was the only acceptable excuse for missing church on Sunday. He left home for military school as a teenager and rarely fished again until his late 30s. In the interim, and before college and law school, he served as both an enlisted man and officer in the Marine Corps and flew over 500 helicopter combat missions in Vietnam. Among his decorations are the Distinguished Flying Cross and Purple Heart. He still carries an AK-47 armor-piercing round in one leg, and he says it causes a weight imbalance that he routinely blames for his frequent bad fly casts. We've all got our excuses. Before he became obsessed with world angling records, his hobbies included running triathlons and flying aerobatics. In addition to an uncontrollable passion for turkey hunting, his angling exploits for the last 10 years have been focused in a large part on taking a world record tarpon on light fly tippet, a challenge at which he has consistently and miserably failed. He is a senior partner at the Mobile, Alabama law firm Cunningham Bounds. And Robert, hey, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And at least we got you out of storm weather here for a while, and hopefully that'll stay that way for a while. And I was just talking to Robert before the show, and he said that pretty much the storm just kind of winged them, and so the fishing's still good, right, Robert?
As far as I'm hearing, it's still great. Everything's kind of settled down now. The water's back to normal, more or less.
Well, let's read your book, and very interesting. Of course, fish stories are always interesting to me. But let's kind of start at the beginning. Like your bio says, you really didn't start back fishing until you're about 30 or so. And is that when you started chasing records, or was it later on in life?
No, it was later on, Roger. In late 1988, I was doing a lot of fishing in the Chandelier Islands, which are about a 40-mile chain that are east of the Mississippi Delta, but fairly close to Mobile by plane. And they are a national wildlife refuge and a fabulous place to fish. I went by seaplane routinely, and that's where I kind of got started. I was catching a lot of really big redfish down there. It's white sand. It's clear water. You can fly over. You can spot the fish, land, and it's wade fishing. So catching the bull reds with fair frequency, and at the same time I went to Costa Rica on a tarpon fishing trip and was laying around one day after a long day of fishing and thumbing through some books and picked up a book called World Record Game Fishes. It's a book put out by the IGFA annually, and started thumbing through it and started looking at the redfish records that existed in the late 80s, and I said, well, I'll be damned. The fish I'm catching are bigger than some of these fish. And so started looking at the rules and decided I was going to give it a shot. And that was when it started.
So that's what got you going on the world records. And so that first fish that you got, I suppose, kind of fueled the engine, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I came back after, you know, getting a little better handle on what the rules were and what the requirements were for a world record, and started fishing in the Chandeliers for a redfish record. I started out with 2-pound line. That appeared to me to be the most doable. And actually, it had that record within about a year. And I was under the badly mistaken impression that because that one had been fairly easy and quick, that the rest of them would be that way. And I was really, really wrong about that. But it got me enthusiastic about trying to get more record, and I did. And I've been working at it for 24 years now.
Now, what was that first, what kind of fish was that, your first world?
It was a redfish. Redfish. It's called a red drum in the record book. That's the scientific name that the IGFA uses. But caught it in about 3 feet of crystal clear water in the middle of winter on a calm day, sight fishing. Wade fishing in the Chandeliers, and it was the first of about three, but the rest of them were very, very difficult compared to the first one. I got lucky, and it went downhill from there.
Oh, come on. You got 56 more others, I think, or maybe
yeah, but,
more.
Yeah, for each one of those, there were lots and lots and lots of failures, I can assure
yeah.
you. That's
yeah.
one thing about record fishing. If you can't live with failure, you better find something else to do, because most of the time, yeah, the fish is going to win and you're going to lose.
Well, you just added, you know, a whole other layer onto the complexity and challenge of fishing. You know, I mean, every time we go out, it's a challenge, you know. But then when you have to up the, you know, raise the bar,
yeah, well, it
makes it even
definitely
harder.
Makes it more exciting, and you don't do, you know, you don't plan on catching fish for supper when you're doing it, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
But most of the time they're, you know, breaking off and you're losing them. It's the
yeah.
rare occasion when you actually catch one. But it's fun trying, and if you're competitive, you know, it's really exciting.
Now, was that first record on the fly, or was that rod and reel? Or?
No, when I first started, I had never picked up a fly rod, and it was on spinning gear. With 2-pound line, and that's what I fished for the first several years that I was chasing records out there, and then started realizing that some targets that made a lot better sense were fly rod targets, and so I started trying to learn how to fly fish, which was a slow process. And eventually, you know, it got where I'd say most of my time was spent fly fishing for records and very little fishing with a rod and reel.
Yeah, I was looking at your record table in the back of your book, and it looks like probably the majority are on the fly, right?
I think that's probably
yeah.
true.
Yeah. yeah. Now, seems like, I don't know how to phrase this, that your approach is maybe different than other people that earn world records, or maybe in line with some and not with others. I see a lot of records, you know, you see some kid in the paper that catches
right.
the
right.
record catfish that weekend while, you know, fishing
yeah.
with his
well,
parents.
Yeah, well, you know, they're different. There are a couple of different categories of chasing records. I think there are people who are not really chasing records and who are fortunate enough to catch a fish that turns out to be a record. And that's great, you know. I think that's great. But then there are a few of us that are crazy enough to spend all of our time doing nothing but fishing for records. And the approach is different in that you are prepared, you select a target, you work toward that target. You may have several targets that you chase during a given year, depending on the seasons, but, you know, you're focused solely on fishing for records and fish that you would otherwise, that you're sight fishing for, that you would otherwise love to catch and keep. If you weren't chasing records, you will, you know, walk by or let them swim by. Rather than wasting time on a fish that's not going to be a record, so you can, you know, you got to use your time wisely if you're focused on a record.
Yeah, because that's just going to take an hour out of your day, which could have been used for record fish.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into that more later. I'd like to hear your, you know, because you do have a strategy, it seems, about going about all this. But I want to talk about, one more question before we talk about the IGFA. Is, are you always looking for new records, or do you try to better your own records as well?
Well, I've done both, and, you know, it really depends on what your targets are and what's available. You reach a point, for example, with redfish. I reached the point where I was fishing in the Chandeliers wade fishing, where I had broken some of my own records. It became apparent that I had kind of hit the max limit for what the biggest redfish I had encountered out there weighed. And so it was then time to move on to other species. And then when we moved on to other species, the same thing occurs. You may break one of your own records, but you reach a point where, you know, the returns are diminishing. The chance of catching a fish bigger than the one you already have is slim. And that, you know, really depends on where you are, what line class you're fishing, what tippet class you're fishing. A multitude of different factors go into that equation.
Right, because it's, I think that, you know, the world records we always see in the paper are usually probably size based on, you know, pretty heavy line class.
Yeah. Well, I think
and they just get
difficult.
Lucky that they can be recorded. But, so let's dive into the IGFA because that's the big, that's kind of your guide, right, as to how you go about
well,
it.
Well, yeah, the IGFA is really the final authority on records. It's, the mission of the IGFA, of course, is game fish conservation and education. And they, since the 1940s, have been maintaining game fish records. So they really are the ultimate rule setter, the ultimate authority for what constitutes a world record. They're the only worldwide body that keeps world records and, you know, certifies world records. So you got to do it the way they say to do it or you don't have a record.
And they're worldwide, right?
Yeah, yeah. They're worldwide, and they decide which fish qualify as game fish and therefore can be fish that are certified as records. They make all those decisions and have been for decades, so they're the final authority.
Well, like fish you might find in India, like the masir or something like that, is that considered?
You know, I'm not familiar with that fish, but anytime I have a question like that, I've got to go to the book because mm-hmm. that's where you'll find the list and the pictures and all the information about each of the fish that does qualify as a game fish. And obviously not every fish qualifies as a game fish.
Mm-hmm.
They're adding fish, you know, from year to year. There are new fish being added, but there are only a limited number that are considered game fish.
Well, I'm thinking like one of our guests we've had on our show, Jeff Currier, is kind of like one of our adventure fly fishers. And he goes after, you know, very obscure kinds of fish like Nile perch or, you know, tiger
right,
fish
right.
in Africa. I suppose. Right. So if it's a new fish to them, can you submit it to them and have them consider it as a new game fish? If it's
the two that you mentioned are in fact game fish. I'm relatively sure of that. But there are different categories of records. You have what are called all tackle records, and those are the records for the biggest fish caught on any tackle. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, a 100-pound line. If it's the biggest fish that's ever been caught, then it will classify or qualify for certification as an all-tackle record. And that applies to a wide variety of fish that are not necessarily considered game fish. In the game fish category, you have fly rod and line class. And within each of those categories for each game fish, you have 2-pound, 4-pound, 6-pound, 8-pound, 12-pound, 16-pound, and 20-pound tippet, for example, for a fly rod. So you can set a record for the same kind of fish on different tippet categories because the skill involved varies, obviously, between 2-pound and 20-pound. Hooking them is one thing, but catching them is something else when you're using very light tippets. So there are plenty of opportunities there, and you have to be very careful in how you select them. I know we'll probably talk more about that later. But
yeah, like I was just looking here in your records, you've got like 7 world records for Crevalli.
Jack Crevalli, yeah.
Yeah, Crevalli.
Pacific Jack, right.
Yeah, so those are all on different class tippets. You go from
exactly
4-pound to 12-pound, 16-pound. So there's a lot of opportunity there.
Right. So, and obviously, you know, the higher class tippets or line class for that matter require less skill in terms of handling a bigger fish.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I want to talk about fish handling later because I think that will even apply to many of our trout fishermen or freshwater fishermen that, you know, I'm sure you learned a lot about playing fish. And have become, you know, an incredibly better fly fisherman because of that, just by trying to use those, you know.
I think it definitely enhances your skill when you learn to fish on very light tippets, but particularly so when you're catching big fish on very light tippets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the rubber meets the road in record fishing, because oftentimes the most logical targets are on the light tippets, and that makes it that much more difficult when you're, you know, fighting a fish. So
I
learned an awful lot. I learned it the hard way. And looking back, I, you know, realize how bad I was when I first started and how many mistakes I made.
Mm-hmm.
I think we learn more from our mistakes and from our successes. And that's certainly been the case with me over the last 24 years.
Right, right. Well, Robert, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back and talk with Robert more about chasing those world records. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging into their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Robert Cunningham about chasing records. If you'd like to ask Robert a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, back to the IGFA. Kind of tell us about what the process is for submitting a world record once you've got one.
Yeah, sure. I think if you're interested in doing that, you have to have a copy of the book World Record Game Fishes by the IGFA. You know, you can order it online. They've got a really nice website. And it sets out all of the rules and requirements and standards for both catching the fish and everything you have to do to have the fish certified. But To put it in simple form, you catch the fish, you've got to have it weighed on a certified scale. You've got to keep the line that you used and the lure that you used or fly or tippet, and that has to be submitted with the fish. The fish has to be photographed thoroughly, and if there's any question about what species of fish it is, you need to get that checked by a game biologist to assure that you've got the right fish, the fish you think you do. And believe me, there's a lot of confusion about fish species. Then you fill out their forms. It's about a two-page form with an affidavit at the end. You have witnesses sign it. You have captains sign it. You submit all the photographs. I think I mentioned you have to weigh the fish on a certified scale, and by that I mean it has to have been certified within the last year. Nowadays, you can have a set of hand scales that the IGFA will certify in advance, which makes it very convenient to do catch and release world records. And so you go through that process, you submit it to the IGFA, and typically it takes about 5 months from the date of submission until it's certified. Of course, in the interim, they can reject the record for a wide variety of reasons. The most common reason I think that I've experienced over the years has been when the line that you used that you thought was 4 pound overtest and it's actually 6 pound or 8 pound. That's not an uncommon experience.
Now, so when you say, and we had a question about this from George Fant in Alabama. He says, if you think you've caught a record fish and you're fishing by yourself, as many fly fishermen do, what do you do next? I mean, can you not catch world record by yourself because you don't
have a witness? Oh, yes. No, you do not have to have a witness. You still have to do everything else. And, you know, witnesses are preferred, but it's not necessary. If you are prepared to sign an affidavit stating that what you filled out on the record form is true and correct. Still have to weigh the fish on certified scales, and they prefer having a picture of the fish on the scales. And, you know, they may do a little checking in the background. I've seen that happen before. But, no, you can fish by yourself and still catch a world record. In fact, you can fish by yourself and do a catch-and-release world record. But you better dot all the I's and cross all the T's. And the only way to do that is to be very familiar with the requirements. And I always carry a record book with me, and if I can't carry it with me, I always have a copy of the records in my, you know, tackle box. So I can refer to them and be sure I've done it all right before I submit the record.
So now when you, for instance, photograph the fish, do you have to have a measuring device in there some way?
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. You not only will have to photograph the fish, but you have to give them various measurements. And, you know, they've had a lot of experience with what measurements equate with what weight. So it better all work out right, you know, or you may have a problem.
Now, so it sounds like in the past you pretty much had to kill the fish and bring it in to get it weighed on a certified scale, right?
Yeah, and that is still the case with larger fish, unless you have in a rare circumstance where there's some other way to weigh the fish and keep it alive. But, you know, in the early days, they did not even have a catch and release method for having a record certified. They have that now, and it works well on smaller fish if you get your scales certified in advance and use those scales to weigh the fish. They have to be certified every year. So, to that extent, you know, if you can, I prefer, obviously, I think most anglers do, if you can, to catch and release your records, but it just doesn't always work out, especially with larger fish. So the IGFA has now developed a new method for world records for some fish, and it's a limited number, but it's a length-based world record. And they will provide you with a measuring device. You measure your fish lengthwise, which you can obviously do with larger fish in a boat or on a beach, and then release the fish, and you can get a world record based on length. The number of fish that are available to do that for is fairly limited now, but I think it's increasing all the time.
What about, for instance, like tarpon, which tarpon are, you know, I think in Florida you can only get one permit,
right.
One fish, to kill one fish.
That's true. Yeah, tarpon's not, as a practical matter, not a catch and release record. But let me tell you, they are so extremely rare. That is, catching a record tarpon is so extremely rare that I think, you know, it's both legal and ethical to weigh that fish in if you think you have a world record. And I can tell you, I've been trying to break a tarpon world record for the last 10 years. And they have whipped me repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
If I ever get the chance to weigh a record in, I can promise you I'm going to do it.
But that one is, well, you're an attorney. You can defend yourself.
Yeah. Well.
You get to the dock
and the
warden's standing there.
No, it has to be, you know, you cannot, that's another point, Roger. Any record that is not legal, that is, if you didn't have all the proper licenses, all the mm-hmm. proper tags, and
okay.
did not conform with all of the game and fish laws that apply to that fish, you don't have a record. So that's one of the first requirements.
Well, so, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Florida is one tarpon, right? You have permit for one tarpon?
I think that's correct.
Bring
I
in
think
the
you
boat.
Get one, I think you get one tag, yeah.
So if you're after a tarpon, you just better be sure that one you bring in is the world record, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And
you
there are ways
that.
To,
yeah.
Exactly.
What about in Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana?
In Alabama, it's a tag system, too. You get one tag per season.
Okay.
But, you know, we, as a practical matter, we don't have a record tarpon here in Alabama. At least I've never seen one.
Yeah.
And you can't fly fish for them here as a practical matter, although I've tried. But generally speaking, it's not an issue here. Now, in Louisiana, they don't have any tag requirements in Louisiana.
Mm.
And there are some big, big tarpon in Louisiana. But
how do they determine the boundaries of that, since it's – did they run the state line out to the sea, or – I mean
– You mean the Louisiana boundaries?
Yeah, for fishing in the ocean.
Well, I think, you know, they're federal waters and they're state waters, and I think the Louisiana laws apply in state waters. I'm not sure how the federal waters govern that, but tarpon are, you know, it varies from state to state, as you know, what the laws are on catching tarpon.
Mm-hmm. So you just have to check with your local state.
Yeah, but, nobody keeps tarpon unless there's an outside chance of some kind of record. And these days, the measuring of a tarpon gives you almost an exact weight if you do it right.
Is that one of the ones that can be measured, or is it?
Yeah, well, I'm talking about before you say, okay, look, we think this is a record, we're gaffing this fish.
Okay.
Before you ever do that, you tape the fish out. And there's a formula you can use. It tells you what you tape, both the girth and the length. And then there's a formula that'll tell you what the fish weighs. And it's very, very accurate. So if you do the measurements and find out it, and the tarpon I'm familiar with that have been records, taped out as records. So
it agreed.
No question about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. So now when you talk about line classes and so forth, since this is fly fishing show, let's just talk about the requirements for fly fishing. And I know you kind of got caught with your pants down a couple of times of not having the right tippet or the leader or something, right?
Well,
you
may be referring to the 2-pound tippet redfish record.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent 7 years trying to break that record, and I, quote, broke it, end quote, 3 times over the first 6 years, only to find out after I'd submitted each of those records and waited 5 months to get a response that the tippet had overtested. And that was back in the, I guess, the 90s mainly. And, you know, you buy a line and the manufacturer certifies it as IGFA line. and then you find out that in fact it's not once the IGFA tests it. So I had the frustrating experience of submitting 3 records over a period of 6 years on 2-pound tippet, and every one of them over-tested. Along came the IGFA's new procedure, which allowed you to send line in and get it pre-tested. So I forget when that was. I think that was later on in the 90s. You could send your line in and have it tested by the IGFA. You know, I'd send a dozen spools in, they'd test them, and they'd come up with 3 or 4 that actually really were 2-pound tippet. And then you could use that line and have a pretty good degree of confidence that it's going to pass the test. And so I got finally, after the 4th attempt, I was using pre-certified line, and it worked finally.
Now, so
this is more of a problem in the smaller tippet categories, 2, 4, 6, than it is once you get into the higher categories. But if you're going to put in the time and effort that is required to get a record that you've targeted, I would highly recommend getting the line that you're using tested in advance, so you don't waste your time and find out that what you thought was 2-pound or 4-pound is actually not.
And then they're going to test it again when you send it in for the.
Oh yeah, they'll test it again. And and by the way, if they test it again and that section of the line overtest, you still are out of luck. But I've found that the line manufacturing capabilities have improved dramatically over the last couple of decades. You know, it's difficult to take something like 2-pound line, if you've ever played with it a little, you know what I'm talking about, and make it consistent over an entire spool. And I think they're doing that a lot better these days than they did 25 years ago.
Yeah. So with fly fishing, we've got, tell us about the terminal tackle options we have, because we've got both, in your case, fishing for a lot of saltwater fish with teeth.
Right,
you've got the shock tippet to deal with and so forth, as opposed to fishing for trout, where we don't have to deal with those kind of things.
Right.
Can you kind of explain the options there?
I know absolutely nothing about fishing for trout in mountain streams, so I'm not.
Okay.
I can assure you that's not something I'm going to comment on, but I can tell you that when you're dealing with toothy fish, bigger fish, tarpon, for example, are not toothy, but they crush what they eat, and they have very, very rough, a very rough mouth. If you're going to fish with 8-pound tippet, you have to have a shock leader on it. And the IGFA has very strict requirements about what that can consist of and how long it can be. It can be up to 12 inches, including the knots, both at the fly and the knot that you connect the 8-pound tippet to the shock, which, for example, in tarpon fishing, may be a 100-pound shock. And that cannot exceed 12 inches, or your record will be rejected if you are lucky enough to get one. So that's just an example of what we do with tarpon. Now, there are other fish, redfish, for example, where you don't really need a shock. The tippet, if you use an 8, that's fine. You can catch a redfish on 8-pound tippet. So it really depends on what species you're targeting.
Now, is that written out in the rules as well? I mean, if you're
after
tarpon, you are allowed shock tippet, but if you're
no, fish, the rules tell you exactly what you're allowed in terms of the length of the shock tippet, and your tippet itself, the class tippet they call it, that is whatever you use in 2, 4, 6, must be at least 15 inches long, and it's connected to the shock tippet, and then from there to your butt section or leader or however you want to rig it up.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you're fishing for a record, go to the book, and it will tell you exactly what you can and cannot do in terms of tying up your leader. It'll tell you what you cannot use and call a fly. It'll tell you, for example, that when you're fly fishing, you cannot troll the fly. You cannot cast from a boat that's in gear. The boat has to be out of gear when you cast, otherwise you don't have a record. So that's just a few examples of the reasons you have to become familiar with what the record requirements are if you're going to do it.
Well, I think, and I can't remember what fish it was, but in your book you had an example of where, however you were rigged, you know, to legally get the IGF a record, didn't work out as far as the actual fishing.
You may be talking about, this was a trip where Gene Montgomery and I were offshore and all of a sudden had what for us was a very rare fish appear behind the boat in the chum line. It was a tiger shark.
Mm-hmm.
It was a juvenile tiger shark, and we tried him on fly and never could get him to do anything with the fly. And then checked the book and found that the 8-pound line class record for tiger sharks, there was no record. I mean, it was vacant. So we thought we'd take a shot at that, rigged up quickly and excitedly, caught a bonita, hooked a live bonita on the end of the 8-pound line along with the leader that we had rigged real quick. And long story short, we caught the fish. And then on the way in to the dock to weigh our world record, I started, as I usually do, just double-checking everything and went back and was measuring the length of the leader, and it was about 2 feet too long. Gene had thought I had trimmed it to head the hook. I thought he had trimmed it to the proper length. There went our record, so we stopped the boat and dropped the fish over and went back about our business.
Oh, boy. Now, that was a case where you actually switched from fly to spinning gear, right?
Right.
Just that, a different kind of record just because
exactly.
Of the opportunity that you hadn't seen ever, right?
Right. And that's another thing, you know, if you're chasing records, you need to be ready, particularly when you're fishing someplace like the Gulf of Mexico with a wide variety of fish. And, you know, you need to be ready for possible records that you're not out there looking for that just happen to show up. This is a good example of that, but there are plenty of others.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me take another quick break here, and we'll come back. We'll kind of finish up with that and talk about how you actually go about the fishing. So we'll be right back. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish, big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snook or tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Robert Cunningham about chasing records. If you'd like to ask Robert a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Robert, we have one of the questions I had is, are there, besides the handbook or the guide that the IGFA has, do they have any other tools that can help you in your quests?
Well, I think I mentioned the fact that they will certify hand scales. I think that's a great tool. That did not exist when I first started fishing for records, and it would have been great if it had. So that's one tool. The second tool is that you can now send your line to the IGFA and have it tested in advance. I think that's a big, big plus. I think the third I would mention is what I discussed earlier, the length measuring device that you can use to measure a record and photograph a record that would comply with the IGFA requirements. So those are a few. Those are the main ones that come to mind.
But really it comes down to more study and preparation on your part.
Absolutely. I guess if you want to call a book a tool, the one you really need is the IGFA rule book and record book. That's where all the information is. That's where all the records are listed, and that's where you can, you know, take a look and see whether there are any realistic records where you're fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people might be surprised to look and find that there are, if they're willing to learn how to fish with light tippets. There are probably a lot of records, and in everybody who's listening to this call in your area, there are probably records available if you work at it.
Yeah, I was just thinking because the next show we're going to do is on Colorado greenback cutthroat trout, which only exist in Colorado and are in high mountain streams. They're not big fish, but there probably certainly is a record to be had there.
Records don't have to be big fish to be records.
Right.
They just have to be the biggest fish ever caught on that particular category of tippet, and they're a record.
Yeah, right. Now, what you have any tips as far as working with the IGFA on, you know, getting your...
I found them really, really easy to work with. They've got some fine folks down there that deal with records all the time that you can pick up on the phone and ask questions about most anything. And now they have a website, obviously, which is they didn't have 20 years ago, and you can get an awful lot of information off the website. But typically, they're there to help you. And if you're not a member, you probably ought to join because you'll get their regular publications, plus you'll get the annual World Record Game Fish book, which not only has the rules and all the records, but a lot of really interesting articles. And it also has, over the years, had interesting articles on how to catch record fish and some of the techniques that some of the really top fishermen suggest.
Mm-hmm. Now, are they always right?
The IGFA, no. there are a lot of people who would say they're frequently not right, but you know, they're kind of like the U.S. Supreme Court. They're the final word. Once they say that's the way it is, that's the way it is.
Do they ever ask for additional documentation or witnesses or things like that? Or?
I've never been asked, but I have heard of people who have been asked. And I don't know necessarily what the circumstances were, but they don't mind rejecting records. I'll tell you, if there's any doubt about whether it's all on the up and up and all in line, they will reject them quickly.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not something they're out to do. They just want to make sure that when somebody...
That's fair. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, now, it seems that regardless of all these requirements, there's a certain amount of trust that the IGFA has in the fishermen.
No question.
Yeah.
They have to, you know, but I don't know why, you know, anybody would have the slightest interest in skirting the rules and getting a record that they put on the wall and look at and know it really isn't a record because they
exactly.
didn't comply with the rules, you know.
Exactly.
What possible satisfaction could anybody get out of that? I guess there's some nuts that would, but most folks that I know that fish would not. No
what
money involved and no cash prizes.
Right. That's right. That's right. There aren't, are there? Be better off go fish tournaments, right?
If that's what you're interested in.
Yeah. The what about, you know, historically, you said this goes back to the 40s. It's kind of like I was thinking about baseball records, you know, how people argue that, well, you know, somebody that breaks a record today has a, you know, they have a better bat or, you know, better workout equipment or whatever, and the rules have changed, the conditions have changed. Do you think that applies here?
I think the equipment is definitely better. A lot of things are better, but it's still a record at the time. And, you know, you caught it was a record.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my records have been broken since then, and I say more power to them, you know. But I've been able to take advantage of the improvements in tackle, just like people who are now catching records. So that's all kind of part of the game.
Yeah. Now, you had said earlier, you primarily target saltwater species, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
We've got great freshwater fishing here in my area. I live in Mobile, which is on Mobile Bay, which opens into the Gulf, but we also have the Mobile River Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kind of great freshwater fishing, but I've grown up in saltwater and pretty much done mostly saltwater fishing over the years.
And how do you go about, you know, picking the fish that you're going to go after? I mean, you're strategic about that right now. I mean, maybe in the beginning.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to be, and that comes down to studying the record book and looking at what the weights of the fish are that you're catching in your area. You know, for example, redfish. If the redfish records are in the 20s and 30s, and the fish in your area are in the 15s and 20s, then that might not be what you want to target. On the other hand, if you look in the book and if you're catching whatever, rainbow trout, and you see that the records in the book are in a range of the big fish that you know can be caught in your area, then you try to select which tippet category makes the most sense for you to fish, whether you feel comfortable fishing 4 or 6 or 8, and what that record is, and then you just have to spend a lot of time and a lot of effort trying to break it. But it makes no sense to target a fish that you're not going to be able to fish far but once every, you know, 5 years, or mm-hmm. that you know from experience it's extremely rare to catch a fish of a certain size, and it's that certain size that you would have to catch to break a record. So it's really a lot of common sense and looking at the record book and studying it carefully.
Well, like you said, I think you said earlier, there's no real trophy tarpon where you live that you know about or try to target.
Well, tarpon's a good, yeah.
Homo sassa is where you go for a trophy tarpon, I guess.
Right, and the reason is if you look in the record book for tarpon on fly, virtually every record has come from the Homo sassa area. There's some different names that you'll find in the book, but they're all from that specific area. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it would make no sense to go to the Keys to try to catch record tarpon if they're all historically have been caught in a particular area, and they have been, which is Homo sassa. So that's where everybody goes in May, typically, to catch the giants. Now, you know, they're still rare, but they're at least a possibility there, and in a lot of other areas, they're just not a possibility. And that same thing, you know, that applies to just about any fish in the book.
Mm-hmm. So we got somebody right in, George Fant wrote in, and he says he's going down the Florida Gulf Coast this fall. He usually fishes for ladyfish and mackerel off the beach. What record fish can be targeted inshore? So he just needs to consult the book, right?
Exactly. And I think he mentioned ladyfish. Ladyfish have been added in recent years as a game fish. And so I know that there are records that George could target for ladyfish. He just needs to figure out exactly what they are.
Now, I also remember in your book you talked about, I think you caught the first tarpon on the fly in which state?
You must be thinking about Louisiana. And,
that was a state record, right?
That was a state record. I fished with a character down there that I wrote about in the book called Coon Swest. He is the guy who invented the coon pop. And Louisiana is not a place, you know, to fly fish for tarpon, but I went with some friends of mine that were fishing for tarpon on conventional tackle and thought I, you know, could take a shot at it down there. It's not sight fishing. It's what we call dredging, or it's, you know, blind casting with sinking lines. And we spent about 5 years before we caught that one fish on fly that is now the state record. That was a 130-pound tarpon. And since then, I've continued to try to break that record. And I think that's been about 5 years ago, and probably hooked two since then. So it's a very low percentage, deal.
Yeah, dredging for him, that's tough work, huh, with the heavy gear.
It's not like, there's no comparison between that and sight fishing in Florida when you're looking them in the eye when you cast to them, you know, in shallow water.
That's the excitement for tarpon, too.
Yeah.
For me, it was. It was like...
Absolutely.
Even if I got to cast to him, I was just excited about that.
Absolutely. That's the way it should be.
When you see him coming at the boat. It's addicting for sure.
And then you get to watch him swim right by your fly like it wasn't even there, too.
Yeah,
most of the time.
Yeah, like they're just taking a Sunday swim, you know, and bye-bye,
exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
Well, what I was getting at by that state record is, are state records a place that you would want to research for sizes to try to figure out whether, like this guy's going down, George is going down for, you know, and he says he catches ladyfish where he's been before.
Right.
Would state records be a place to look for also to see
you know,
big ladyfish there?
I paid very little attention to state records. The only reason I was interested in that fly record in Louisiana is because nobody had ever taken a tarpon on fly that was, you know, there was actually a picture and that you could see. And the fly rod record for tarpon was totally empty. And so that's what got me interested in that. But other than that, I know very little about state records. If I were George, I'd be looking at the IGFA book for ladyfish on the tippet categories and, you know, see what they are, because it hadn't been a category for that long, I don't think. And so there may be some realistic targets there.
And see if, because in the documentation, it always says where they're caught.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
You know, so that's another way to target fish. You see where the fish have been caught. If it's someplace you can actually get to the fish on some kind of a regular basis, then that's where you need to go. You need to be where the fish are.
Now, Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas wrote in, he says, what one piece of advice would you give when picking a species for a chance at a world record?
Yeah, well, I think I probably said this earlier, but pick a fish that you know you can spend some time working on. You know, if you can only take one trip a year somewhere, one every couple of years, your percentages are very low. If you've got a fish that's in your backyard or in your neighborhood that gets as big as you need it to be for you to break a world record, then that's where you need to be, not chasing something that's too exotic to spend much time working on.
Right. Like, don't expect to take a 3-day trip to Homosassa, Florida and get
exactly.
your world record, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Expect to spend several weeks there every year.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or how many years?
You just got to do whatever it takes to up your percentages is what you got to do.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Martin also wrote in and wanted to know about preparing for a world record attempt on any fish. So, you know, once you know that you're going to go after a particular fish and you've gone in, you know, I guess your first thing that you do is check the book, find out what class tippet and do all those measurements. So
right.
Where do you go from there? Do you pre-prepare a bunch of leaders and tippets and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you're fishing in a place where you may have multiple shots at multiple different fish in different categories, we would always have dozens of different pre-tied tippets ready to go in different categories. I would bag them up and have the bag marked with what the shock was and what the tippet was, and depending on what target appeared around the boat, for example, in a chum line, you can switch out real quick. And, you know, we'd take different size rods, and different size reels, and pretty much be ready for anything.
Yeah, what about the rods and reels? Is there any specification as to the rod? Obviously it would have to be a fly rod for fly fishing.
Got
to
be a fly rod. Everything's got to be consistent with customary fly rod or fly fishing, and, you know, that's part of the rules. But, you know, you can use whatever weight fly rod. Nobody's going to tell you that if you're fishing for this kind of fish, you got to use a 6-weight or an 8-weight or 10-weight or anything like that. You have to use your own judgment on that.
Now, did you find that through experience that certain weight rods worked better with, you know, the lighter weight tippets? And
you know, it really is so variable that it's just almost impossible to generalize. But I will say this, that if you are going to start fishing light tippets for the first time with big fish, I mean, I know, or at least I assume that you guys that fish the mountain streams and lakes and all that, you know, use light tippets all the time. But if you're fishing for really big fish, let's say you're fishing for cobia on light tippet, that's your target, you need to break an awful lot of tippets as you practice before you go chase that particular record. By that I mean, I always spent time in my backyard. I'd tie tippets and tie them to something in the yard and breaking them to get a feel for how much pressure I could put on a fish. And, you know, that varies with distance from the fish, varies with the stretch of the fly line you're using. There's all kind of different variables, but the only way to know what it feels like and then apply that to actually catching a fish is to get out and do it and maximize the pressure until the line breaks, and then you know, well, I don't need to go that far. And then, of course, you know, all of that changes depending on the rapidity of movement of the fish when you've got the pressure maximized. So all kind of variables. But if you hadn't done that, you're going to be completely lost when you all of a sudden hook up with that big fish. And, you know, you want to put it as much pressure as possible, as quickly as possible, but you don't know where that line is. So
I think that's
something you have to do with the light tippets.
So, you know, if you're targeting tarpon, let's say, and you're normally using a 12-weight rod, you would still use a 12-weight rod just with the lighter tippet? You wouldn't?
No, not necessarily. Now, I used a 10-weight, for example, with 8-pound tippet for tarpon, 11-weight sometimes, but with a 16 or 20-pound tippet, 12-weight was a typical rod. Now in Louisiana, where you're dredging, I'd use a 14-weight with a 20-pound mm-hmm. tippet.
Because you're dragging a lot of line through the water and so
right, like right.
So you do have, that's kind of what I was getting at, you do have potentially a different feel on the rod and with the tippet, because I would imagine it would feel different between a 10 or 11 or 12.
No question about it.
Yeah.
No question about it. And it's not so critical in the 12, 16, and 20 tippet categories as it is in the 2, 4, 6, and 8,
mm-hmm.
Where you really, you know, you're on the edge the whole time you're fighting the fish, so you really have to develop a feel for it. And the way you develop that is by either breaking it in your yard or breaking it when you got the fish on the line.
Right, right. I remember we did a show with Andy Mill. Do you know Andy Mill?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
do.
Big tarpon fisherman, and I remember him telling about how he would, out on his patio, he would weigh out the weight, put it in the bucket or whatever, and then attach
right.
his fly rod to the bucket, and then just stand out there, pull on it,
yeah.
till he had memory, you know, muscle memory of what
exactly.
that was.
Yeah, it's just he writes about that in a book he published recently called A Passion for Tarpon, I think.
Right.
Name of it, and that's just another way of doing what I'm talking about. You
mm-hmm.
got to get a feel for breaking the line so you know what the maximum pressure is you can put on the fish. That's as a start, and then there are all kind of variables that occur during a fight that you got to, you know, deal with.
Right, right. I'm going to ask you about the... Oh, I think you had a couple of times when, and maybe this is under lessons learned, you know, some early mistakes that you made fighting fish. I think in your book you said that you weren't maybe as aggressive early on as you should have been.
Yeah, right.
And you want
right.
to talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, as you know from the book, it's not about the successes I had, but it's more about the failures and what you learn from your failures. And early on, I think one of the biggest mistakes I made with light line was not putting enough pressure on the fish and being afraid of breaking the fish off, which leads to long, long fights, and you end up aggravating the fish a lot more than you do catching him. And I came to realize over time that, first, I would not use drag settings on the reel, whether it was a spinning reel or a fly reel, but I would use my hand and feel the pressure and use it as the drag system and maximize the pressure on the fish when the fish gave any sign at all of tiring or weakness. And you can't do that if you use a drag setting. If you say, okay, well, I'm going to set my drag at 60% or whatever the breaking strength is, you'll never catch the fish, or a lot of times you won't if it's a big fish. So you've got to, you know, kind of learn to treat it like a street fight, and you better get in and knock the other guy out quick and get it over with, or it's going to be a long, miserable day. And I had a lot of those long, miserable days and learned that lesson the hard way. So
I want to come back to that in just a second, but we need to take a quick break. So return to that thought in about 30 seconds. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or you can call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. It's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Robert Cunningham about chasing records. If you'd like to ask Robert a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. You receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many as possible on the show tonight. Yes, so on fighting fish, on light tackle, are there any tips you can give as far as, you know, angle of rod, things you do in or in the boat or not do in the boat, that kind of thing?
You know, I think, I hate to say it this way, but it's really something you just got to get out and do and screw up lots of times before you finally figure out what to do and what not to do. And I don't know that I've got a formula for it. I think one of the best things I can tell anybody to do for the light tippets is break a lot of them and get a feel for, you know, your rod. Everybody, I think, pretty well familiar with the fact that the time you're going to lose the fish with a big fish on light tippet is usually in the last few minutes of the fight, up when he's up close. So you got to back off. You got to learn to be self-disciplined enough to back off the drag, whether it's an actual, you're using your drag or using your hand, which I prefer to use my hand. You better back off when he gets close, even though the temptation is to do just the opposite. Fighting tarpon, there are all kinds of tips for that. I'm sure you're familiar with it since you've done it before. But every fish is different, and while there's some basic things you do the same all the time, I think you just gotta adapt your technique to whatever fish you're dealing with and, you know, your experience with that particular line class. And you only get that by failing multiple times.
Well, I know, and this may be basic for some people, but someone talked to recently, a guide or something, said that the biggest mistake he saw, and this was dealing with freshwater fish, but I think it applies to probably saltwater fish as well, is, and you can do this with smaller fish, is, you know, you see trout fishermen hook up and then lift their rod straight up in the air and fight the fish from a high point.
Right.
Which was pointed out that, you know, that's probably the worst way to fight the fish, even small fish, because you're not leading the dance, so to speak.
Right, right. You're not really putting pressure on the fish because it's the bottom part of the rod that you're fighting, you know, should be fighting the fish with. So, yeah, I think that's a habit all of us have, and it's easy to do that. But if you're fighting a lot of big fish, you quickly learn that that'll waste an awful lot of time high-sticking them, and not to mention the fact that you'll break your rod from time to time.
Yeah, you had that experience once, huh?
Oh, yeah. I've had it more than once. I've had it a lot more than once, but one I wrote about in the book was a good example of how not to do it.
Go ahead and tell us. Tell us what happened there.
Well, that was a cobia. I assume that's what you're referring to. I don't know if I
remember.
Yeah, a giant cobia. I had the biggest cobia I'd ever laid eyes on, and I, at that point in time, had recently caught two records, both in the 75-pound category, and this one was twice as big as those fish. And I was fishing in the Gulf alone and hooked him up near a rig on a perfect set of fly tackle. You know, I had a big Able and I had a 14-weight Sage, and it was just me and him. And, you know, I just knew this was going to be the biggest cobia ever caught on fly. At that point in time, the biggest was about 60 pounds, a record that I had from a couple of years earlier. So this was going to just about double the record. Fought him for, I don't know, you know, 2 or 3 hours, if I remember right, and had him up to the boat. My problem was I didn't know how I was going to gaff him and get him in the boat, and I had my mind on that problem. I didn't think I could get him over the side by myself. Nobody else around for me to wave over. And while I was thinking about how I was going to do all that, my rod exploded in my hands. And if anybody's ever had that happen, they know, you know, it's like a gun going off behind you. The problem, of course, is that once that happens, IGFA rules require that the fish be caught on a rod of a certain length. And my rod, after it exploded, was no longer of the certain length. So there went the record. And I debated whether to take the fish in just to be able to say I'd caught one, even if it was on a broken rod, caught one that big, and decided that I would not do that. That what I would do, and this was about 20 miles offshore, is I would release the fish, and he would go back to that same rig where I'd found him that day, and that I would come back the next morning and go back and catch him again. And of course, I went back the next morning and never laid eyes on him again. So that was that.
Yeah, not much you can do about after the rod breaks, huh?
Well, and yeah. You know, it was a foolish mistake because I was high sticking the fish close to the boat. I mean, and I had exactly. I was putting too much pressure on him and high sticking him, and it like I say in the boat, as a pilot, to me, that's as dumb as running out of gas, you know, mid air. So
yeah, but that sounded like an exciting fish too. So well, since you brought up the cobia and being alone. You did talk about in your book about fishing a lot for cobia, and that really is a team effort in many cases. And for a lot of people that have never had that experience, and I didn't quite understand exactly how that worked, because you, in general on a boat, you would have you on the rod, and as the requirements state, nobody can touch your rod or your line or anything, right?
That's right. That's one of the rules. It's very clear in the book that once you're hooked up, nobody can assist you. And by assist, the rules say that means touch you, the line, the tackle, anything. And those rules are clear. But on the cobia, there are two different ways that we catch cobia. One is, just like I described, you go out, you put out a chum line, or you're around some structure offshore, and the cobia will come to the boat. They're just attracted to it, even sometimes with no chum out. You can catch them that way on fly, sometimes. An awful lot of the times they're very finicky, and everything you put in front of them they ignore. The other way that we catch them, which is the method you're referring to where it requires teamwork, is during April there's a migration. There's an east-to-west migration along the northern Gulf Coast across Florida, through Pensacola, through Orange Beach, Alabama, Gulf Shores, Alabama, and the fish head on over to Mississippi. But during April, the cobia fishermen fish the beach. The fish migrate on top, often in schools or singles or doubles, and you can sight fish them. So the way we do that is you be in a large boat, got a tower, you've got the captain driving the boat, you're on the bow as the angler, and he's looking for the fish, you're looking for the fish, you've got a mate on the boat who is also looking for the fish, you spot a school, or you spot a single fish, and he sets up the boat so that you can make a cast of the cobia. But what you have to do is use a teaser rod and a teaser man, and that's the mate. He has a live eel hooked up to a spinning rod, and once the boat is set up, you know, he can cast that eel 100 yards, 75 yards, and with a weight on it, obviously, and then he teases the cobia toward the boat. He jerks the cobia, he jerks the eel out of the water when the cobia is in fly casting range, and then you put an eel fly in front of the cobia that was chasing the live eel. And then he eats the eel fly. And theoretically, that's how it's supposed to work. Obviously, that in all, you know, doesn't work that way all that often, but that is the teamwork you're talking about. It's between the captain, the man on the teaser rod, and the angler on the bow. And it really takes an awful lot of teamwork to make all that come together and work. It does.
Yeah, timing is everything there. And then once you get if you did hook up and successfully fight the fish and get it to the boat, then that involves, even though they can't touch anything, you do get help in trying to boat that fish, right?
Gaff is allowed. It's limited to 8 feet, can't be any longer than 8 feet, and you cannot use a flying gaff like you can when you're fishing line class. I may not have mentioned, but there's specific rules for fishing rod and reel and specific rules for fishing fly rod, and one of them is that you can only use an 8-foot gaff and it cannot be a flying gaff. But sure, yeah, once you get the fish up to the boat, the mate or the captain or whoever can gaff the fish.
And at that point, anybody can have hands on to anything, right?
Yes, at that point.
Yeah. Well, we're running close to end of our time here. What has been the longest fight you've had, whether successful or not successful?
Well, the longest, there have been a couple of them that are very close to this, but the longest is an 8-hour-plus fight off of Homosassa with a tarpon on 8-pound tippet that was clearly would have been a world record if we had caught the fish. But it was a long battle. We were in a 15-foot flats boat that, you know, has got a very low gunwale, and the fish took us offshore, headed west into the sun, and that we were beaten to death. The sea breeze was really strong, and the boat almost sunk, and we almost caught the fish. I think we hooked him up about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and at about 8:30 or 9, when it was getting real, real dark, we finally just had to make a gaff shot. The fish was right up close to the boat, and the guide took a shot at him with a gaff, and when the gaff hit the fish went crazy, and the gaff did not penetrate, and we lost him at the boat. But he was in the, you know, 140, 150-pound range, which would have beat the 8-pound tippet record.
Mm.
Woulda, coulda, shoulda, though, you know. That's kind of...
Do you think that was your biggest disappointment in going after records, or was there something?
That was pretty close, but there have been plenty of them. There have been other fights in the 7 and 8 hour range, particularly with tarpon, that, you know, we've lost at the last minute. It's just a fairly common experience when you're fishing light tippet with these big fish. All kinds of bad things can happen. And, you know, they may happen at the start, and they may happen in the middle, and they may happen in the end. So until the fish is in the boat, actually until you got your record certificate, it's not a world record. It's a woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Right. What do you consider your biggest success so far?
Oh, gosh.
The one you're most proud of. Well, big or small, it doesn't matter, you know.
You know, it's hard to say because you remember the failures so much better than you do the successes. I just, they're just so many of them, it's hard for me to say. And all of them were the product of a lot of failure and a lot of hard work. So I'm proud of all of them. And I really, it's the failures I remember better than the record.
So I
can't really pinpoint one.
So, are you still in the hunt, especially for the record tarpon?
Yeah.
Still on the bucket list?
Yeah, I've been down to Homosassa again this year and fished for 7 days straight and hooked one fish. That's kind of the way it is down there, but the one I hooked was huge. I got 2 jumps out of him, and he was off on the second jump. Been to Louisiana, still fishing down there some, and have hooked 2 fish. And when I say hooked, that's on and off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's tarpon fishing.
Now, when you said you were in Homosassa for 7 days, hooked 1 fish, was that because you were being selective or?
No.
Period. Huh?
It was tough fishing, and it's a very tough place to fish for an awful lot of reasons. But over the years, the fish have become more scarce. But the big fish are still there. The one I did jump in that 7-day period was the biggest one I've ever laid eyes on in the air. And it's the reason you keep going back, because you've got a shot at fish like that.
Right. Well, good. Well, we got to wrap things up here. And stick with me, though, Robert. And we're going to give away a few prizes here, including your book, Chasing Records, courtesy of Skyhorse Publishing. So stick with us, folks, here, and we'll be back in just a minute. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S, familyties.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show. It says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. And the winners for the drawings that we're going to do here are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show. So you don't miss out on a chance to win one of these prizes. So if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a great organization to support and be part of. And if you aren't, you might want to find out more about them by going to www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Flyfishers.org. And let's see, our winner there is Stephen Bodenstab of Illinois. So, Stephen, you just won a one-year membership to the FFF, and if you already have one, we'll get that extended for you. So congratulations, Stephen Bodenstab. And we'll also give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And if you are unfamiliar with that, go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com, a great magazine to subscribe to, lots of great articles and good information in there. Our winner there is Todd Bijan in Virginia. So, Todd, congratulations on winning that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So now, we need to give away Robert's book here, Chasing Records, courtesy of Skyhorse Publishing. And as I said, if you're not a winner tonight, just go to Robert's speakers page on our site. You'll find links to Amazon or just search Chasing Records. So I'll make this real easy tonight. For those of you listening out there, if the question is what's probably the most important thing you need to have with you when fishing for a world record? What's the most important thing you have to have with you when fishing for a world record? So let's see, Robert, here, if we get an answer. This was definitely a different kind of show we've done tonight. We've never done anything like this before. And I've got one answer here. It's not really what I was looking for. He said camera. Not quite. Robert, what do you think? Most important thing?
When you're
going after a world record, not when you've got one.
Yeah. Well, the record book is important, I'll say that.
Well, you just gave away the answer. So let's see if... Oh, we got camera and IGFA book, but nobody's name on it, so I have no clue who just won that. So if you can be fast about it again, you'll probably be the winner here. So... yeah, it was after. Yep, here's another one. Right answer, no name. Need to put your name in there, folks, if you want to get the win. So we'll get one of these people that can type fast here in a second. There we go. Okay, we got a name in the IGFA record book. Joe Herndon, you just won yourself Robert Cunningham's book, Chasing Records. So congratulations. Joe, be sure you send over your mailing address and so forth to me, either in that same box that you just answered the question in, or to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll get that book sent out to you by Skyhorse. So thanks, and congratulations. Well, Robert, we really appreciate you being with us tonight. It was a real pleasure to talk with you and on a real unusual subject for us, and I learned a lot about it. So thanks for being
with us. Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you, Roger.
Well, thank you. And hopefully everyone out there has all found our archive on our website. If you haven't, there's a couple of links to it on our homepage and links on the bottom of every page. If you go to the archive, you'll find our past shows, over 155, I think, at this point, which you can search by keyword or keyword phrase like trout or tarpon or or cobia or whatever, and learn more about what you're fishing for and where to fish. So go ahead and explore it, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you discover. On our next broadcast will be on September 19th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern, and on that show we'll interview Jim Rubing, and our topic for the show will be Colorado's greenback cutthroat trout. Once thought to be extinct, Colorado's famed greenback cutthroat trout is now in the process of making a remarkable comeback. Listen in to hear how Jim Rubing and Richard Fritz explored Colorado in search of the greenback cutthroat, where they found them, and the best strategies for putting one on your prize catch list. We would like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Royal Gorge Anglers, Flats Time Charters, and Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8, and we'll be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.